Chapter 42. Directly the cargo boat had slipped away from the wharf and got lost in the darkness of the harbor, the Europeans of Sulaco separated to prepare for the coming of the Monterist regime, which was approaching Sulaco from the mountains as well as from the sea. This bit of manual work in loading the silver was their last concerted action. It ended the 3 days of danger, during which, according to the newspaper press of Europe, their energy had preserved the town from the calamities of popular disorder. At the shore end of the jetty, Captain Mitchell said goodnight and turned back. His intention was to walk the planks of the wharf till the steamer from Esmeralda turned up. The engineers of the railway staff, collecting their Basque and Italian workmen, marched them away to the railway yards, leaving the custom house, so well defended on the first day of the riot, standing open to the four winds of heaven. Their men had conducted themselves bravely and faithfully during the famous 3 days of Sulaco. In a great part this faithfulness and that courage had been exercised in self-defense, rather than in the cause of those material interests to which Charles Gould had pinned his faith. Amongst the cries of the mob, not the least loud had been the cry of death to foreigners. It was, indeed, a lucky circumstance for Sulaco that the relations of those imported workmen with the people of the country had been uniformly bad from the first. Dr. Monaghan, going to the door of Viola's kitchen, observed this retreat marking the end of the foreign interference, this withdrawal of the army of material progress from the field of Costaguana revolutions. Algarab torches carried on the outskirts of the moving body sent their penetrating aroma into his nostrils. Their light, sweeping along the front of the house, made the letters of the inscription, Albergo de Delia Una, leap out black from end to end of the long wall. His eyes blinked in the clear blaze. Several young men, mostly fair and tall, shepherding this mob of dark bronzed heads, surmounted by the glint of slanting rifle barrels, nodded to him familiarly as they went by. The doctor was a well-known character. Some of them wondered what he was doing there. Then, on the flank of their workmen they tramped on, following the line of rails. Withdrawing your people from the harbor? Said the doctor, addressing himself to the chief engineer of the railway, who had accompanied Charles Gould so far on his way to the town, walking by the side of the horse, with his hand on the saddle bow. They had stopped just outside the open door, to let the workmen cross the road. As quick as I can. We are not a political faction, answered the engineer, meaningly. And we are not going to give our new rulers a handle against the railway. You approve me, Gould? Absolutely, said Charles Gould's impassive voice, high up and outside the dim parallelogram of light falling on the road through the open door. With Sotillo expected from one side, and Pedro Montero from the other, the engineer-in-chief's only anxiety now was to avoid a collision with either. Sulaco, for him, was a railway station, a terminus, workshops, a great accumulation of stores. As against the mob, the railway defended its property, but politically the railway was neutral. He was a brave man. And in that spirit of neutrality he had carried proposals of truce to the self-appointed chiefs of the popular party, the deputies Fuentes and Camacho. Bullets were still flying about when he had crossed the plaza on that mission, waving above his head a white napkin belonging to the table linen of the Amarillo Club. He was rather proud of this exploit, and reflecting that the doctor, busy all day with the wounded in the patio of the Casa Gould, had not had time to hear the news, he began a succinct narrative. He had communicated to them the intelligence from the construction camp, as to Pedro Montero, the brother of the victorious general, he had assured them, could be expected at Sulaco at any time now. This news, as he anticipated, when shouted out of the window by Senor Camacho, induced a rush of the mob along the Campo road towards Rincon. The two deputies also, after shaking hands with him effusively, mounted and galloped off to meet the great man. I have misled them a little, as to the time, the chief engineer confessed. Over hardy rides, he can scarcely get here before the morning. But my object is attained. I've secured several hours' peace for the losing party. But I did not tell them anything about Satillo, for fear they would take it into their heads to try to get hold of the harbor again, either to oppose him or welcome him, there's no saying which. There was Gould's silver, on which rests the remnant of our hopes. Deckard's retreat had to be thought of too. I think the railway has done pretty well by its friends without compromising itself hopelessly. Now the parties must be left to themselves. Costaguana for the Costaguaneros, interjected the doctor, sardonically. It is a fine country, and they have raised a fine crop of hates, vengeance, murder, and rapine, those sons of the country. Well, I am one of them, Charles Gould's voice sounded, calmly, and I must be going on to see to my own crop of trouble. My wife has driven straight on, doctor? Yes. All was quiet on this side. Mrs. Gould has taken the two girls with her. Charles Gould rode on, and the engineer-in-chief followed the doctor indoors. That man is calmness personified, he said, appreciatively, dropping on a bench, and stretching his well-shaped legs in cycling stockings nearly across the doorway. He must be extremely sure of himself. If that's all he is sure of, then he is sure of nothing, said the doctor. He had perched himself again on the end of the table. He nursed his cheek in the palm of one hand, while the other sustained the elbow. It is the last thing a man ought to be sure of. The candle, half-consumed and burning dimly with a long wick, lighted up from below his inclined face, whose expression affected by the drawn-in cicatrices in the cheeks, had something vaguely unnatural, an exaggerated remorseful bitterness. As he sat there he had the air of meditating upon sinister things. The engineer-in-chief gazed at him for a time before he protested. I really don't see that. For me there seems to be nothing else. However, he was a wise man, but he could not quite conceal his contempt for that sort of paradox. In fact, Dr. Monaghan was not liked by the Europeans of Sulaco. His outward aspect of an outcast, which he preserved even in Mrs. Gould's drawing room, provoked unfavorable criticism. There could be no doubt of his intelligence, and as he had lived for over 20 years in the country, the pessimism of his outlook could not be altogether ignored. But instinctively, in self-defense of their activities and hopes, his hearers put it to the account of some hidden imperfection in the man's character. It was known that many years before, when quite young, he had been made by Guzman Bento chief medical officer of the army. Not one of the Europeans then in the service of Costaguana had been so much liked and trusted by the fierce old dictator. Afterwards his story was not so clear. It lost itself amongst the innumerable tales of conspiracies and plots against the tyrant as a stream is lost in an arid belt of sandy country before it emerges, diminished and troubled, perhaps, on the other side. The doctor made no secret of it, that he had lived for years in the wildest parts of the Republic, wandering with almost unknown Indian tribes in the great forests of the far interior, where the great rivers have their sources. But it was mere aimless wandering. He had written nothing, collected nothing, brought nothing for science out of the twilight of the forests, which seemed to cling to his battered personality limping about Sulaco, where it had drifted in casually, only to get stranded on the shores of the sea. It was also known that he had lived in a state of destitution till the arrival of the Goulds from Europe. Don Carlos and Dona Emilia had taken up the mad English doctor, when it became apparent that for all his savage independence he could be tamed by kindness. Perhaps it was only hunger that had tamed him. In years gone by he had certainly been acquainted with Charles Gould's father in Sta. Marta. And now, no matter what were the dark passages of his history, as the medical officer of the San Tome mine he became a recognized personality. He was recognized, but not unreservedly accepted. So much defiant eccentricity and such an outspoken scorn for mankind seemed to point to mere recklessness of judgment, the bravado of guilt. Besides, since he had become again of some account, vague whispers had been heard that years ago, when fallen into disgrace and thrown into prison by Guzman Bento at the time of the so-called Great Conspiracy, he had betrayed some of his best friends amongst the conspirators. Nobody pretended to believe that whisper. The whole story of the Great Conspiracy was hopelessly involved and obscure. It is admitted in Costaguana that there never had been a conspiracy except in the diseased imagination of the tyrant, and, therefore, nothing and no one to betray. Though the most distinguished Costaguaneros had been imprisoned and executed upon that accusation. The procedure had dragged on for years, decimating the better class like a pestilence. The mere expression of sorrow for the fate of executed kinsmen had been punished with death. Don Jose Avellanos was perhaps the only one living who knew the whole story of those unspeakable cruelties. He had suffered from them himself, and he, with a shrug of the shoulders and a nervous, jerky gesture of the arm, was wont to put away from him, as it were, every allusion to it. But whatever the reason, Dr. Monaghan, a personage in the administration of the Gould concession, treated with reverent awe by the miners, and indulged in his peculiarities by Mrs. Gould, remained somehow outside the pale. It was not from any liking for the doctor that the engineer-in-chief had lingered in the inn upon the plain. He liked old Viola much better. He had come to look upon the Albergo d'Italia Una as a dependence of the railway. Many of his subordinates had their quarters there. Mrs. Gould's interest in the family conferred upon it a sort of distinction. The engineer-in-chief, with an army of workers under his orders, appreciated the moral influence of the old Garibaldino upon his countrymen. His austere old-world republicanism had a severe, soldier-like standard of faithfulness and duty, as if the world were a battlefield, where men had to fight for the sake of universal love and brotherhood, instead of a more or less large share of booty. "Poor old chap," he said, after he had heard the doctor's account of Teresa. "He'll never be able to keep the place going by himself. I shall be sorry." "He's quite alone up there," grunted Dr. Monaghan, with a toss of his heavy head towards the narrow staircase. "Every living soul has cleared out, and Mrs. Gould took the girls away just now. It might not be over safe for them out here before very long. Of course, as a doctor I can do nothing more here, but she has asked me to stay with old Viola, and as I have no horse, to get back to the mine, where I ought to be, I made no difficulty to stay. They can do without me in the town. I have a good mind to remain with you, doctor, till we see whether anything happens tonight at the harbor," declared the engineer-in-chief. "He must not be molested by Satillo's soldiery, who may push on as far as this at once. Satillo used to be very cordial to me at the Goulds and at the club. How that man'll ever dare to look any of his friends here in the face I can't imagine. He'll no doubt begin by shooting some of them to get over the first awkwardness," said the doctor. "Oathing in this country serves better your military man who has changed sides than a few summary executions." He spoke with a gloomy positiveness that left no room for protest. The engineer-in-chief did not attempt any. He simply nodded several times regretfully, then said, "I think we shall be able to mount you in the morning, doctor. Our peons have recovered some of our stampeded horses. By riding hard and taking a wide circuit by Los Hatos, and along the edge of the forest, clear of Rincon altogether, you may hope to reach the Santome Bridge without being interfered with. The mine is just now, to my mind, the safest place for anybody at all," Com promised. "I only wish the railway was as difficult to touch." "My Com promised?" Dr. Monaghan brought out slowly after a short silence. "The whole Gould concession is Com promised. It could not have remained forever outside the political life of the country, if those convulsions may be called life. The thing is, can it be touched? The moment was bound to come when neutrality would become impossible, and Charles Gould understood this well. I believe he is prepared for every extremity. A man of his sort has never contemplated remaining indefinitely at the mercy of ignorance and corruption. It was like being a prisoner in a cavern of banditti with the price of your ransom in your pocket, and buying your life from day to day. Your mere safety, not your liberty, mind, doctor. I know what I am talking about. The image at which you shrug your shoulders is perfectly correct, especially if you conceive such a prisoner endowed with the power of replenishing his pocket by means as remote from the faculties of his captors, as if they were magic. You must have understood that as well as I do, Doctor. He was in the position of the goose with the golden eggs. I broached this matter to him as far back as Sir John's visit here. The prisoner of stupid and greedy banditti is always at the mercy of the first imbecile ruffian, who may blow out his brains in a fit of temper or for some prospect of an immediate big haul. The tale of killing the goose with the golden eggs has not been evolved for nothing out of the wisdom of mankind. It is a story that will never grow old. That is why Charles Gould in his deep, dumb way has countenanced the Ribierist mandate, the first public act that promised him safety on other than venal grounds. Ribierism has failed, as everything merely rational fails in this country. But Gould remains logical in wishing to save this big lot of silver. Decket's plan of a counter-revolution may be practicable or not, it may have a chance, or it may not have a chance. With all my experience of this revolutionary continent, I can hardly yet look at their methods seriously. Decket has been reading to us his draft of a proclamation, and talking very well for 2 hours about his plan of action. He had arguments which should have appeared solid enough if we, members of old, stable political and national organizations, were not startled by the mere idea of a new state evolved like this out of the head of a scoffing young man fleeing for his life, with a proclamation in his pocket, to a rough, jeering, half-bred swashbuckler, who in this part of the world, is called a general. It sounds like a comic fairy tale and behold, it may come off. Because it is true to the very spirit of the country. Is the silver gone off, then? Asked the doctor, moodily. The chief engineer pulled out his watch. Be by Captain Mitchell's reckoning and he ought to know it has been gone long enough now, to be some 3 or 4 miles outside the harbor, and, as Mitchell says, Nostromo is the sort of seaman, to make the best of his opportunities. Here the doctor grunted so heavily that the other changed his tone. You have a poor opinion of that move, doctor? But why? Charles Gould has got to play his game out, though he is not the man to formulate his conduct even to himself, perhaps, let alone to others. It may be that the game has been partly suggested to him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.